this hour of the 2018 Homelessness Marathon on NCRA stations across Canada is produced by CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby on the unceded ancestral Coast Salish territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples. In the hour ahead, a short documentary about Maine and Hastings, the renowned East Vancouver intersection that is the de facto center of homelessness in Vancouver. Music by homeless musicians from across British Columbia's Lower Mainland. And a feature on Away Home, a multi-organizational effort spearheaded by the United Way in Kamloops, aiming to address youth homelessness through a broad, multifaceted approach called the Rap Force model. First up, some music. Ricky from East Vancouver kicks the hour off with the theme from Beverly Hillbillies. From East Vancouver to Surrey, Carla is a volunteer at the Surrey Urban Mission Society, who has previously struggled with homelessness and addiction.
Hi, my name is Carla. I've been low income for quite some time now, and I find one of my biggest challenges is housing, adequate, affordable housing. I've been an addict for on and off most of my life. I've struggled with all sorts of different addictions, And I'm proud to say I'm clean right now.
Congratulations.
It's been a really tough battle becoming clean. And I'd say the last while that I've been a participant in some of the programs at Surrey Urban Mission have also helped a great deal with friendships and volunteerism.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that came up in another interview about the loneliness that people feel when they're dealing with addiction. And because you may have alienated your family or your friends, and then your only friends are the people that you're an addict with. So that's great that, you know, Surrey Urban Mission is offering not only the vast number of services that they offer here, meals and whatnot, but that you're forming friendships and positive friendships, right?
Yes, the friendships are so important. I suffer from depression as well. I do not like the medication that has been offered to me. I don't feel any better. My mood may improve, but the effects it has on my body is horrible. And I find that's where a lot of the people out there struggle, because the medication is so disgusting that they much rather self-medicate than take the medication offered.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you are clean now. You were using Surrey Urban Mission services before you were clean, I'm assuming. And then Jonquil mentioned that you are now volunteering here at Surrey Urban Mission. I think that's fantastic. So how long has it been, if you don't mind me asking, since you were clean? And what's going on in your life right now?
Well, clean from most things for many, many years.
Good.
From marijuana, it's only been a couple of months now,
yeah.
I think, since mid-December.
And so you are not homeless now at this time. What was the catalyst when you became homeless?
Well, I had two catalysts that got me into Surrey. I used to live in Vancouver with a roommate, but that was a very unhealthy relationship for both of us. And so I ended up moving out to Abbotsford with a friend, and that fell through. He wanted to move to the island, and I did not. So I ended up stuffed in a little tiny apartment, maybe, if I was lucky, 400 square feet. And now the second situation like that, I ended up living in a really nice two-bedroom sharing, and he moved out to Chilliwack. So, and luckily both parties were totally clean, so that also helped me stay clean. But this accommodation is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who wants to live in 400 square feet with no closets?
Right. So what do you do here at Surrey Urban Mission?
I've been helping in the kitchen. I started out in housekeeping when a lot of donations came in and it was given out to the homeless the homeless guests. Then I moved to the kitchen because that's where I had 3 years worth of experience.
There's so many issues that need to be tackled, need to be talked about, and I appreciate you taking the time to share with us your experience. It's raising awareness for everybody out there. Hopefully, we'll make a difference, and somebody will hear this, and we'll affect some change somewhere. That's our hope anyway. So thank you very much for sharing it with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Homelessness Marathon on campus community radio stations across Canada. This hour is produced by CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby on the unceded ancestral Coast Salish territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples. Up next, a documentary about Vancouver's infamous intersection of Maine and Hastings, produced by David Swanson.
You have people on the streets severely addicted, always, always, always trying to generate the pennies that maybe turn into the dollars, that turn into $5, that will get you not high, but unsick. Once you've managed to scrape money together, you need to try and acquire your drugs without getting beaten up, bunked, which is sold phony drugs, or busted by the police. There's that fraught process. You are getting more and more desperate and dope sick. Now you finally manage to acquire the drugs and you have to get them in you. People hide in doorways. Many, many people go into the alleys and use behind dumpsters, which is a good place to hide. Now, needless to say, dumpsters in an area that faces a high, high, high percentage of homeless people, that area behind dumpsters is also used as the public toilet for the neighborhood. So it is probably the least hygienic area on earth for a medical procedure. But that's where that is being performed. And you are trying to get this fixing as quickly as possible, standing behind the dumpster. Your feet are in human waste. And you get your rig out and you get your dope out. You do not have the space, nor do you have the time to filter these drugs. You dump them into the end of the rig, and you will be doing what's called a shake and bake. You put the drugs and the water in the rig, you put the capper back, the plunger back in, shake your rig, run your lighter or your torch under it. That is not killing bacteria. It's not going to raise the temperature enough. You have this unfiltered drug in there, and after doing that as briefly as possible, then you need to find a vein. So what happens is you are looking for a vein, and you're looking up, looking for cops, looking at your vein, looking up, looking for cops. You're multitasking where you need to be single-tasking. That's disaster enough, but there's further indignity if you overdose. And then being hidden behind a dumpster is a real disaster, because nobody's going to see you, and when you are found, chances are you're going to be dead.
Should the person described in this scene go to the hospital or to prison? Are they sick or are they a criminal? Addiction is a health problem. Drug use should not be treated with criminal penalties. Whether it's cigarettes, alcohol, or heroin, addiction is a health concern and needs to be treated as such. Unfortunately, addiction to Schedule I drugs like cocaine, crystal meth, or heroin will land someone in prison long before they see a healthcare professional. Despite ever-increasing investment from governments and law enforcement, the use of illicit drugs has seen no significant reduction. Furthermore, those engaged in the drug trade have found increasingly sophisticated ways to make their actions lucrative. Clearly, there is a need for a policy shift, at least when considering use, possession, and addiction. Harm reduction needs to become the leading strategy when addressing illicit drugs. This is the only way any profound and lasting results can be attained. Vancouver's downtown east side is home to one of the most severely drug-addicted communities in Canada. It is also home to Insight, a safe injection site that works to minimize the harm Schedule I drugs exact on people living in that area. Insight's approach to addiction is harm reduction, the strategy that works to minimize the negative effects drugs have on a group of people. It is a controversial approach. Its opponents often view it as a form of enablement. They believe that those who practice harm reduction have condemned the user to a lifetime of addiction and are simply guiding them to an early grave. This is Conservative Health Minister Tony Clement sharing his views on Insight, safe injection sites, and harm reduction.
But for the poorest of Canadians, who live in conditions of extreme poverty, enslaved by an addiction for which full recovery is possible, we have been offering supervised injection, needle exchanges, and crack pipes. We have been offering drug maintenance rather than drug treatment. We have been sending a message, we have given up on you. We do not expect you to recover. Now, Vancouver Mayor Sam Sullivan, just a few weeks ago in an editorial in the Globe and Mail, called the SIS, quote, palliative care. This echoed the report of a committee struck by the BC Medical Association in 1997, which called harm reduction, quote, the palliative care of addictions medicine. Palliative care is what you give someone when there is no more hope. It is end-stage treatment when every other solution has failed and we just wait for people to die. But injection drug users do not necessarily have to die. There is still hope for them. Even if they fail treatment the first time, we can help them to get up and to try again. In purely medical terms, it is unethical to offer palliative care when treatment could help. I would want health workers, and more importantly, I would like my government not to give up on my child, but to help me win him or her back into society and into health and wellness. That is what this government's national anti-drug strategy is all about, and what we need to think about when addressing the exemption at Insight. This much I know as health minister: the illicit drugs that which are being injected as part of harm reduction at the supervised injection site are harmful to human health. In my opinion, supervised injection is not medicine. It does not heal the person addicted to drugs. Each and every injection, along with the heroin and cocaine injected, harms the person. Injection not only causes physical harm, it also deepens and prolongs the addiction. Programs to support supervised injection divert valuable dollars away from treatment, and government-sponsored supervised injection sends a very mixed message to young people who are contemplating the illicit use of drugs.
Minister Clement's summary of Insight's purpose is oversimplified and incomplete. He labels it as palliative care, but doesn't mention the life-saving and rehabilitative medical services that take place there every day. This is Darwin Fisher, the manager of Insight, explaining how the facility runs on a daily basis.
The primary goal of Insight is to reduce overdose deaths, in fact, to prevent overdose deaths on the premises. We have had thousands of overdose interventions without fatality here, right? The second priority here is to reduce the spread of disease. We do that, and I mean, harm reduction, as we talk about it, becomes so basic in some ways. To be able to inject where there is running water and soap, so you can wash your hands in the injection site before you inject. We haven't even gotten to talking about clean equipment, nursing care, better injection practices, things like that. But those are really important as well. Single use to a booth, trying to put some order to a phenomenon that out in the street is absolutely chaotic, is one of the goals here. And disease prevention is a primary goal that way. The third aspect of the mandate is to try and build relationships and trust and to treat with respect this incredibly marginalized population that a lot of times wants to go absolutely the opposite direction when they see representatives from, you know, society's various bureaucracies, whether that's the hospital system, the welfare system, or the police system, right? We need to sort of reach out from society and see if we can make a bond with the people that use this site. The research that has been done has actually shown that there's a decrease in this specific area that we are, and that's largely our catchment around the 100 block, which is where most of British Columbia and Vancouver's entrenched addicts reside, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a reduction in overdose mortalities in this area, which I think is attributable to this site. We, at times, a great, great deal, about 80% of the injections that get performed here are performed by under 20% of that 13,000 person database, meaning that core group of 2,000 to 3,000 people. They live in the area, they are predominantly homeless. For many of them, this is their primary health service. I do not go to a clinic, I do not go to the emergency room unless I have to. Insight is the only place that I'm seeing healthcare professionals, and it is that group that is the most at risk and the most marginalized and the most chaotic that forms the largest group of people that are here day after day after day. And that, I think, is the highest risk group for overdose in this country. And ministering to that group, having them use here, having oxygen, having Narcan, having observation, you know, observant staff looking at them, that is having a significant reduction of that overdose number. And the idea was that we would try and have access to other services from this. The most notable service that is directly on top of us is on-site detox.
Minister Clement says that the conservative anti-drug strategy is one based on treatment. Yet, the treatment they provide, through investment in traditional healthcare, is not easily accessible to this severely drug-addicted and marginalized population. Clement's definition of treatment has also manifested in the form of harsher punishment. While the Vancouver Police Department has supported Insight's presence in the downtown east side, the federal government and the RCMP believe that stricter enforcement of drug laws is needed to curb drug use. They believe that this will act as an effective deterrent in reducing the number of people who start using drugs and therefore become addicted. This legislation assumes that addicts are thinking logically and have the foresight of a typical, well-adjusted person. But they don't. This strategy falls short because addicts aren't looking beyond the next fix. By no means are they in a healthy mental state. Regardless of why an addict starts using drugs, their continued use is simply to avoid becoming dope sick. Dope sick is the intense physical need and desperation for another fix caused by drug withdrawal. At this point, an addict isn't using to get high. They're simply using to return to a level of physical and mental normality. This dependency ensures demand remains high. And even though it is this dependency that fuels the drug trade, current laws fail to address it. Rather, legislation works to remove addicts and dealers from neighborhoods like the downtown East Side, creating a vacuum that other addicts and other dealers will eventually fill. Isan Jozagi is a master's student in the School of Criminology at Simon Fraser University. His research focuses on the impact Inside has had on the downtown East Side community. Now, he counters Clement's assertion that harm reduction is just a death sentence. Jozagi believes that harm reduction is, in fact, an effective strategy with both personal and economic benefits. With Inside acting as a stabilizing force in the downtown East Side, addicts can start to manage their addiction and then begin to contribute back to society.
You can't make somebody stop using drugs because their body needs it. Unfortunately, after a point, there is no return. After some point, when somebody starts using drugs, once they reach that point, they can never go back. They can, but it's going to cost a lot of money for society. So what we can do is reduce the HIV and hepatitis C transmission. Each HIV case is, on average, costs $150,000 to $250,000 to taxpayers' money. So it's a lot of money. Hepatitis C is the same thing. Hepatitis C is cost a lot of money to be treated. So what happens if we give free heroin to people who are truly addicted and been addicted for a long time? It reduces the cost of criminal justice system. People are less likely to go to jail, to cost the taxpayers money, less likely to commit crimes. If we could reduce the criminal activity in the downtown East Side by providing free heroin, we can actually not only reduce crime in the neighborhood, we could create safety in the neighborhood. We could destabilize the peoples who are addicted to it, and maybe they're able to find jobs and contribute to the economy. Mm-hmm. Research shows, which is NOAMI, have you heard about it? North American Opiate Medication Initiative, which is a program that has been run from Montreal and Vancouver, which provided free heroin to users who qualified for the program. They've been users for a long time. So what happened was that people were able to stabilize their lives. They're able to reduce their intake of drugs. Some people are able to, once they get their heroin, they're able to function. They're able to go to work. They're able to pay their taxes and contribute to society. Before the supervised injection facility opened in the downtown East Side, it was a situation where you had people overdosing every day. In the alleys, you would see the HIV and hepatitis C epidemic, same as some third world countries in Africa. It was that bad. 25% HIV rates, 90% hepatitis C transmission rates. It's unbelievable. It's the only one in North America. It's that bad. Mm-hmm. So, like, the government had no choice. They had to do something. And the only thing they could do is reduce harm. Because you can't fix somebody overnight. You can't tell them not to use drugs. Drug addiction is a health problem, not a criminal justice issue.
This evidence shows the positive impact safe injection facilities can have for impoverished, drug-addicted communities. Yet the RCMP still believe that harm reduction does not attempt to decrease drug use or effectively fight the harmful repercussions of addiction. Chuck Doucette worked for the RCMP for 35 years before retiring in 2007. More than 30 years were spent in various roles with RCMP Drug Enforcement in Vancouver. For over a decade, he served as the Drug Awareness Coordinator for BC and the Yukon. In 2009, Doucette did an interview with Canada's C2C online journal. He was quoted as saying,
The definition of harm reduction is that we try to reduce the harms to a drug user without trying to get them to stop using the drug. This creates a cycle of drug use with no end in sight. I visualize it this way. It's like you have a pool of deep water. There are people constantly falling into the pool and can't get out. If they stay there, they will eventually drown. Prevention strategies would be teaching them not to go close enough to fall into the pool. Treatment would be pulling them out of the pool. Enforcement is like putting up fences to keep them away from the pool. Harm reduction, however, is like throwing them a life jacket and letting them stay in the pool. You are never really dealing with the problem. Only prevention and treatment will reduce the number of people in the pool. Focusing solely on harm reduction allows the problem to keep on increasing. The strategy should always be on how to reduce the number of users in the first place.
Even more unsettling is policymakers' continued support for prevention tactics that do not work and simply exile users to the fringes of society.
Without a doubt, the biggest stereotype around harm reduction and around the supervised injection facility is that somehow this is abetting drug use or encouraging drug use. The idea that vexates me completely that addicts need to have it a little tougher. The idea that addicts need to hit bottom before they're going to clean up. That making things a little bit worse, that making them feel a little bit less supported and a little bit more marginalized has some sort of healing property. This is complete bullshit. And the idea that treating someone with respect, with human decency, that warmth, that lights, that running water, that clean equipment somehow is encouraging people to use is absolutely ridiculous, because addiction has its roots and it breeds in trauma. Trauma. And there are emotional and psychological issues that the people that use this site are plagued with. The backgrounds that they come from, the entrenched users, are filled with childhood sexual abuse, childhood violent abuse, childhood homelessness, grinding poverty. These are the precursors and the abettors of addiction. Clean running water, friendly staff, these things help stabilize and reduce addiction. So this idea, again, of addicts having to hit bottom, you know, and that if we prevent them from hitting bottom, we're somehow keeping them from getting to that point where they're finally changed and burst into sobriety. This is a religious and moral narrative that is absolutely bankrupt. These black and white narratives, damned when you're an addict, and you need to just get right to the fucking bottom level of hell, and then suddenly, like a phoenix, you will be saved and emerge into the light as a sober person for the rest of your life. What a harsh black and white image that is. It goes completely against the common sense grain of incremental change. I don't know if you've ever changed on a dime and changed your life all of a sudden, and today was the first day of the rest of your life. We don't fucking do that shit, you know? We change with repeated attempts slowly, and change happens best when we barely notice.
Whether or not addiction stems from social pressures or misguided behavior, the problem of addiction will not be resolved until it is treated as a medical issue. The goal of criminalizing drug use is to reduce the prevalence of addiction and its detrimental results. But, by looking at the downtown east side, it's clear Canadian policy has failed. By framing drug addiction as a health issue instead of a criminal matter, users are viewed as people and not deviants. This shift in perspective is vital to building a social infrastructure that is capable of dealing with the problems that arise from substance abuse. The facts don't lie. From 2003 to 2010, Insight reduced HIV risk behavior in the downtown east side by 70%. During these 7 years, Insight has treated approximately 1,800 overdoses without a single fatality. Here, harm reduction is practiced to its full potential. Lives are saved, disease is controlled, and addicts are rehabilitated. Users are dependent on Schedule I drugs because they lack an adequate support structure in their lives, like a job, a family, secure housing, and a community. These things would give them the sense of purpose and dignity needed to move beyond their addiction. Safe injection sites are more than just a place to safely shoot drugs. They are a key pillar for a very isolated population that has no other means for rebuilding a life that is about more than the next fix.
Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war.
It's not available options. And the idea was that we would try and have access to other services from this. The most notable service that is directly on top of us is on-site detox. So the idea, we can get people right in the area where they are as well as we can, and that we can try and lever people into higher threshold medical services that they need. How can we get you involved in this process? And you're in charge of the outcome and the path you want to take. I don't want to force anything on you. I want you to be directing this process whenever possible. The idea that change is an incremental thing, inculcating that approach in people, being very congratulatory about the contemplation of detox or wellness, you know, but centering that within the person, not externally. When people feel that they owe their sobriety to an external force, that to me is a very weak position. So anything we can do to awaken people's drive towards wellness as the primary engine of their wellness is really, really important. Now, when people go upstairs, very often we're trying to connect them with appropriate treatment programs, or appropriate housing, or medical care. What they need is a sense of community, a sense of direction, basic health care, basic living standards, and you know, maybe they might need a little bit of counseling or care that way, but they're enormously self-directed. Issue is, after you get done with the arc of your treatment, what do you go on to? Do you have housing at the end of it? Do you have some new place in the community at the end of it? We need something to sort of fill the back end of that continuum after treatment to give people something else to move on to.
Welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon on campus community radio stations across Canada. This hour is produced by CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby on the unceded ancestral Coast Salish territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples. In the second half of this hour, a profile of Away Home Kamloops, an innovative cross-organization partnership tackling youth homelessness with a holistic approach.
Bernard Richard, I'm the representative for children and youth for the province of British Columbia. There's a very, very strong network of community organizations. So whether it's in the greater Vancouver area, the Lower Mainland, or Victoria, or in other parts of the province. I mean, I visited in Kamloops last spring and really learned about a wonderful initiative in trying to address youth homelessness in that area.
My name is Catherine McParland, and I am the Youth Homelessness Manager of the Away Home Committee in Kamloops to prevent, reduce, and end youth homelessness.
Away Home is an incredible organization. When I first started, I didn't think I'd be where I am now doing the work that I do, but Away Home has opened so many doors. It's helped me see the struggles that youth have in not only the community I live in, but in several communities. And it makes more sense when you look at it through those eyes, because then you know where the problems are and you can help try and fix them as best you can, given the time that you're given. Nice to meet you. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Kira.
I've been with Away Home for 3 years. Kira's been with us how long?
6 months. They're both paid youth advisors.
I first got in contact with Catherine through a youth outreach service, and we started talking, and Away Home was talking about hiring a youth advisor, which was a first-of-its-kind position, and she told me when the position was available, and I applied. It entails a lot. I do a lot more than I think I know. I facilitate our Youth Against Youth Homelessness group. I sit on the Away Home Committee as co-chair of our meetings. I sit on the leadership team. I do a lot of different number of things. Basically, I advise with a youth perspective on things that normally adults do, like proposals, youth surveys, and anything that pertains to youth in that matter.
When we conducted our youth homelessness count last October, we determined that 56 youths were currently homeless, and 129 had previously or were currently experiencing homelessness within that year, just within our community. That's like at the minimum a number, because with youth homelessness, it's very hidden. So we had to do a bunch of magnet events to try and draw youth out to do the survey that we had for that count. So it's very shocking, 129 to have experienced homelessness in a year, and that's only a minimum. It's really shocking.
So when we did our youth homelessness count, we did it with the same point, the government-issued point-in-time count, and so we had to use their survey that was provided to the Canadian government, which was very difficult because it was very legal and very complicated language. So it made it even more difficult for the youth homelessness count, because youth don't want to read complicated surveys and they don't want to read complicated questions. So we tried our best, and this coming May, we're doing the youth homelessness count again, but we're not doing it with a point in time, so we can refine the survey and we can make it more youth-friendly.
Especially when it comes to decisions that are going to affect the youth and the services that they're going to be receiving, they should definitely have a say in how it's implemented, because they know what's best for themselves. So as youth advisors, we bring their voice forward and any concerns that they have. I've seen a lot of my friends, colleagues, have to go through a lot of difficulty when it wasn't necessary, and having a way home here to provide that wraparound service and support for youth to have a successful transition is incredible, because it's not an easy thing, and if you don't have the family to rely on or any sort of support otherwise, you can't really do it on your own. Society fights against you. I found from my own experience that a lot of...
When a youth is on the streets, they're at risk of a numerous amount of things. And so when they get housing, when it's available for them through the RAP Force, it kind of opens their eyes to a new beginning, because they're finally off the streets. They can finally find a stable job. We have rental subsidies for them in case they need, you know, 1 month they're a little bit short. They can access money through RAP Force and through a way home. And it makes them feel at home again after being on the streets, even for a short amount of time, but especially if you've been on the streets for longer periods of time. Homelessness can happen anywhere, anytime, with anyone, rather than bigger cities like Vancouver, Toronto, Winnipeg. It can happen in any city, big or small.
There are really huge gaps in terms of aging out of care. Transitions from care is a really big issue for me. It's one of our priorities here.
So I grew up as a child in care and a youth in care. So I was a permanent ward at age 13, which means that the government is legally your guardian at that point in time. I went through 28 different foster homes. Yeah. At that point in time, while I was in care, there was definitely a lot of support. The Ministry of Children and Family Development has really come a long way in recent years with creating the Agreements with Young Adults program and some opportunities for post-secondary education. At the point in time when I aged out of care, they didn't have those resources, so it was a very distinct cut of services. And so what ended up happening is shortly before my 19th birthday, I received income assistance papers. So that was supposed to be part of my transition planning, was to be on welfare. And then I aged out of foster care. And shortly after aging out, I had secured housing and had met a abusive man. And at that point in time, that person kicked my door in, and I didn't have anyone to support me to keep me safe. And so I ended up losing my housing because of that aggressor, and then ended up on the streets on the first day of snowfall. And so for me, that experience was similar to what happened when I came into care. I like to refer to it as the trauma of apprehension. When I came into care, I felt like I lost my entire family, like I was disconnected. And so that experience was recreated when I was aging out, as I felt like I lost my entire support system.
When it comes to aging out, there needs to be some policy differences so that the youth transition from care into living on their own a little bit better, because a lot of the youth fall through the cracks because they don't have the life skills, they don't have the proper way of thinking, because a lot of the life skills that you learn in your own home, like bills, budgeting, and all that, that's the job portion of being a foster parent, not the parent part. So a lot of the youth in foster care and government care don't get those necessary life skills to be able to budget with their rent and their other bills that they have. Something we can change is have the youth work with the foster parents as they get closer to that age of aging out.
Yeah, and like one of the things I really want to stress with that too is that it's not the youth's fault. It's a system failure, because the government is supposed to be acting as the youth's parental guardian, and they're not.
You know, I have four sons, children, and most families never really age out of care. They can count on the support of parents for throughout their lives, certainly moral support and encouragement, but sometimes financial support as well, well beyond the age of 19. But for kids in care, it's certainly not the same. They've lived through trauma before. They may have been moved around many times. Alex Gervais, for instance, 17 times in 11 years. They might have changed schools. They might have had to build new friendships. And it's really difficult.
I think the challenge is when youth age out of foster care, there needs to be that transition to adult services, as well as a shared responsibility through all of the different government ministries to support youth as a vulnerable population. So my name is Ruby Barclay. I am a fourth-year child and youth care student at Vancouver Island University. I also work at VIU as the peer support navigator for the tuition waiver program. I work to help students with lived experience in foster care to help them navigate post-care and post-secondary. So a lot of the work that I do is serving as a relational bridge for students to services, as well as supporting VIU to enhance services to meet these students' needs. One of the issues that I face in helping these young people navigate the resources available to them is they work in silos, and like every single report that's been recently released from RCY has mentioned and talked about a comprehensive system of care, which would look like kind of that wrap force approach, which is providing all services instead of creating silos within them. Because when we examine why young people age out into adverse outcomes, we have to look at the intersections of where these outcomes where they kind of have synergies and where they connect or where they reinforce one another. And so I would say that, yeah, taking a wrap force approach or creating that kind of a model would essentially create sustainable community supports for young people, and would be, I guess, creating that comprehensive system of approach that the RCY has been advocating for young people for so long. So I really feel that every experience that we go through, every trauma, every hardship, there's a purpose, there's a meaning. And if you can find that silver lining in the clouds, you'll make a huge difference for other people that are going through similar things. So for me, I struggled for a few years. I lived on the streets. What really impacted me was I was working as a peer researcher, and I connected with 30 different foster siblings that had all aged out of foster care. And the outcomes were not good. And so 80% of these youth, this was informal research, had aged out and were now homeless and had created a family of their own on the streets. So I think that by really going through that experience and seeing that it wasn't an individual fault, that it was a system factor. I think it's given me some lived expertise so that I can help make a difference in the system for other youth. And so it's been quite a big, long journey. Definitely education has played a crucial role. And finding a sense of purpose is what has been the most meaningful process for me. And I found that sense of purpose through this work and just trying to ensure that no other youth has to go through that experience, because it was really hard. A couple of years after finding housing, I was working at another nonprofit called Ask Wellness, and began to identify so many youth experiencing homelessness on the streets. And so they were spending a lot of time out of an adult housing first building. And so after having conversations with many of these youth, I discovered that a lot of them had also aged out of foster care. And so I really wanted to create change and to have their voices heard. So I called together a group of people, and we met in an abandoned building, very fitting for youth homelessness.
Yeah.
And we began to discuss how we could innovate solutions. At that time, the city of Kamloops had applied for a mobilizing local capacity grant through EVA's initiative. And we were one of two communities that were chosen to develop a youth homelessness action plan. And so we had this grassroots collective of people that were very passionate in trying to create change. And so the city approached us and asked us to become the steering committee behind the Away Home plan. And so we did. And then we became Away Home Kamloops. And then the national organization that had the Mobilizing Local Capacity Program had shifted out of that and morphed their own new nonprofit. And they took the name Away Home Canada to represent the work that was happening here in Kamloops. Today, Away Home is incredible. It's a movement in Kamloops. We have a committee of 130 people from all sectors. This includes businesses, youth, landlords, nonprofits, Indigenous organizations. We all have a role to play in this work. And our goal is to really become family for those kids who have none, to recreate that family privilege for young people. And so what we've been able to do is incredible and really gives meaning to everything that I have experienced in my life. And I know we're making a difference in the lives of young people. We created the Kamloops Youth Housing First RatWorks intake system for youth experiencing homelessness or aging out of foster care. And so youth become connected to the sector opposed to an individual organization. And as a community, we really wrap around that youth and we provide them access to a continuum of housing and the supports they need to sustain it. It's so important, and the core value that really informed the development of the RAP Force was no wrong door. We wanted to ensure that youth could walk into any organization or ministry and say, I'm homeless, and be supported to transcend that experience. And so it also ensures that youth are not having to tell their story over and over and over again, which can be quite re-traumatizing. And it also allows us as a community to really work collaboratively and innovate new solutions that are based on the individual. So it's really person-specific instead of trying to make an individual fit into a system. So definitely, I think something that's really unique about Away Home is the first voice experience. And so first voices is a term that we use to describe youth with lived expertise of homelessness. So we have a group of 10 youth that have formed a group called Youth Against Youth Homelessness, and they provide peer support, and they've recreated that family experience for many of their peers. So I think peer support is really crucial in developing that network of healthy supports. Also, having really caring, supportive adults in your life that are professionals, but that are also willing to recreate that family privilege and really support the young person is crucial. We also, when we receive a referral of a youth, if they are experiencing family conflict, we really look at how we could support that young person to reconnect back home with their natural supports if that's a goal that the youth has identified. And sometimes maybe returning home is not a viable option. And then we explore some of the natural supports. Perhaps it was a soccer coach back in the day or an old group home worker that the youth really felt connected to. And we really look at how we can bridge those connections. We work really intensely with lots of different supports for the young people. But what I think actually makes the biggest difference in supporting young people to gain that self-esteem and interdependence, I don't think independence is something we should be striving for, because we want youth to be interdependent and rely on a community of support and also contribute. And so what we've done is with the Youth Against Youth Homelessness Group, they've really found a sense of purpose there. They are leading projects. They're creating meaningful work that is making a difference in the lives of their peers. And in that work, they have pride, and it's building their strengths. And we've had young people that have volunteered with Youth Against Youth Homelessness that were so inspired that they've gone into the human services field. So I think it just shows that by providing opportunities for young people to give up or to give back and build those skills is so crucial. On a day-to-day basis, I would say to anybody that's listening, no matter what role, no matter what sector you come from, we all have a part to play. When you walk past a young person on the street, I encourage you to stop and say hello. Are you okay? Is there anything that you need? I believe we, even as citizens, we all have a duty to assist. And that duty to assist may look different. It may look like a kind word. It may look like a coffee. It may be like just reaching out to a young person, as they may not have anyone else to turn to. I would tell a young person that's listening to this to never give up, to know that you're not alone, that there needs to be changes, and that we would welcome them to join us, and let's advocate for changes together, and to find the silver lining in any hard experiences that they may have had, because sometimes those wounds can be the greatest power in creating change for other young people. If you have a dream, if you have an experience that you think could help enact change in the system or create change for other young people, to follow it. You never know where it's going to lead. And one of our core values within Away Home is being rooted in action. And that's certainly how we've operated. The urgency to support youth has always been at the forefront. And instead of kind of speaking and talking and creating plans, we really ensure that all of our work is really rooted in being action focused.
You've been listening to CJSF 90.1 FM's contribution to the Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting on campus community radio stations across Canada. This hour was produced on the unceded ancestral Coast Salish territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples. In this recording from CJSF's 2016 Homelessness Marathon event at Rain City Housing in Coquitlam, formerly homeless staffer Alex performs an original and an old favorite.
Alex, how are you tonight?
I'm good, thanks.
Awesome. Okay, so you're a resident here.
I'm actually not a resident.
You're not a resident.
I work here full-time.
You work here full-time, yes.
I was formerly homeless before I started working here. I was either homeless or under the poverty line. And now they hired me. I'm doing a lot better in life.
It sounds like it. So can you tell us some of the challenges that you faced when you were homeless?
I mean, there's an automatic stigmata just from walking around with a big backpack and a dog. People look down on you. You hear get a job, bum, or stuff like that all the time. But, I was traveling most of the time I was homeless. So, people in Canada have been really friendly to me. And, I got a lot of good places and had a lot of good company doing it.
So I'm sure a lot of people that struggle with homelessness wonder how you got from that place to working for a facility and having a job.
lots of good friends. I live with lots of friends, and the biggest challenge for me getting a job while being homeless is I have my dog. So that's why I rely on being a musician, and that's how I made most of my income.
I see. Okay, so you're going to play some banjo for us. How long have you been playing banjo for?
I've been playing about 8 years.
Wonderful. Okay, so what song are you going to start with?
Well, I'm going to do some covers that you probably wouldn't expect to hear on the banjo.
Okay, let's do it. Banjo time. And if you're just joining us, we are at the National Homelessness Marathon at 3030 Gordon, and now we're going to hear from Alex on the banjo.
This hour of the NCRA Homelessness Marathon was produced on the unceded ancestral Coast Salish territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples by the volunteers at CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Stay tuned.